to another episode of We the People Radio. There we go. My sound all screwed up. Ah, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And your sound's great to me.
My sound is cured. I couldn't fix my computer. I couldn't fix my sound. I basically couldn't fix anything.
Good thing you're not the engineer.
That's a good thing. Yeah. Boy, don't give me the buttons. Ashley's back with us again this week. So we have two great guests today. I think that you will learn a lot. I know we're going to, because these are both topics that we have never covered and just really haven't looked at. So in the first hour, we're going to have an interview with Donna Garner, who is going to tell us all about how they've returned phonics to Texas schools. And just in case you didn't know they were gone, she's going to explain to us what they did to that, which, of course, will make it harder for kids to learn how to read. So all of us that are old, we all learned phonics.
But can the group read? That's all that's important.
That's right.
As long as the group
can read. If everybody knows one word, they can...
And they all agree on it, then that's what it says.
That's right. That's true. They can just make it up.
That's right.
We're doing a lot of that lately. Yep. And in the second hour, actually, that's a good lead-in for the second hour, because in the second hour, we have Myron Magnet, who's the City Journal editor at large, and he's going to talk to us about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution.
Ah, yes, I was reading about that.
Mm-hmm. So, kind of interesting. So, let's see, let's give you a little bit about Donna. She taught for more than 33 years, so veritable expert in the teaching field there. She was appointed by President Ronald Reagan and reappointed by President George Bush to serve on a National Education Commission. She was subsequently chosen to serve on the English Language Arts Reading and Writing Team for Texas, and they call that ELAR, I'm assuming, E-L-A-R, English Language Arts and Reading. So, let's see, when they developed standards for the public schools in 95 to 97, and it's called the Tex Education Standards, and we need her to decode that for us here in a second. She was also the lead writer of the Texas Alternative Document for ELAR when classroom teachers grew concerned about the lack of explicitness, grade level specificity, and measurability of the standards. She and her fellow teachers later updated and renamed the English standard, English Success Standards. Because honestly, if the standards are screwed up, that's really where it begins. You might not ever reach them, but if you don't even have the right goal, you're going the wrong direction. She works without pay for the Texas Board of Education. Sorry, I work near the Board of Equalization. It all goes back to my neighborhood, doesn't it? And they adopted those standards in May of 2008. She was named an Upton Sinclair Award winner in education for 2013, and she is an education policy commenter on educationviews.org.
I'm feeling a little left out. I'm the only one in this conversation that isn't an English teacher.
That didn't become a school teacher and stay there or leave. Stayed there. I left. You never started.
Please don't correct my grammar.
We've covered everyone. And I've actually connected a bunch of her articles on the website. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. So, there we go. Donna Garner, are you in there with us?
I am. Hi, Erin. How are you doing?
Hi, thank you. And we have Bill on board here, too. I guess I forgot to tell you there was going to be Bill.
Yeah, there's me.
Yeah, Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you, Donna? Thanks for coming on with us today.
Good to meet y'all.
Okay, so all of your information is loaded with reference to text, T-E-K-S. What is, I'm assuming it's Texas Education.
No, it's Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. That's the official title of Texas's curriculum standards that we have in K through 12.
All right, so all I pulled was Texas. I knew the T was for Texas.
I know, all these acronyms.
So,
crazy, but anyway, that's the curriculum. Those are the curriculum standards.
Go backwards with us. For people who either didn't have kids in school or, or too young or whatever reason, but they didn't know that the education standards were all changing,
Bill, because when I start talking to people, I always go back to the fact that we have only two philosophies of education, and I have named them arbitrarily Type 1, which is traditional, academic, fact-based. It's what all of us at our age learned.
Mm-hmm.
We all had those kinds of standards, and they were explicit. And we knew that there were facts, and we had to learn foundational knowledge, and that involved spelling and cursive and grammar and, of course, wonderful classic literature in history. We all learned, you know, to love our country. We learned about the founding fathers. We read the Constitution. We read the Bill of Rights. We didn't read snippets. We read the whole deal. And that's why, and I think it's great to think about this right here at the time of 4th of July, because we, you know, we revere you and Bill and I and people at our age. You know, we revere our founding fathers, and we revere what they did and the foundation upon which they set our wonderful American exceptionalism. And we are an exceptional nation. So all of those things I call type one. And those, you know, you have type one in math too. It's just, you know, type one would be learning, your algorithms, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, you know, learning, the wonderful, facts in math. And then of course that applies to, science. You know, we learn the scientific method, or we learn that things are fact-based and you prove them through the scientific method. All of those things, that's type one. And there, when you make questions based upon type 1 standards, you have right or wrong answers. There's no relativism. It's not based upon your feelings, emotions,
right,
and opinions. And it's fact-based. So that's type 1.
What the group thinks is right.
Well, yeah. We're getting to that, Bill. That's type 2. Okay, type 2 is where everything is subjective. So it's all based upon what you think and how you feel and what your opinions are. And that, of course, is what we're seeing taking over our country. And so there are two philosophies. And on the second type, the questions you ask, of course, would all have subjective answers. And the answers then are based upon the value system of a person who's grading your paper, right? Because there's no, you know, right or wrong. So those are the two philosophies. So I always go there first. And what happened is we have always had this battle in education between those two types. But when Obama came along, he came in, of course, with the Common Core Standards. And the Common Core Standards are type two. And there was a very definite plan. And people got off thinking, well, this is all about academics. No, it was not. And, you know, his plan really had nothing to do with raising academic proficiency, although they sold it on that, you know, with that marketing plan. This, of course, never was voted on by Congress. Common Core Standards were never voted. There was never a single vote taken on Common Core Standards. It was thrust upon our country through the race to the top, and most of the states across the country bit the apple and they grabbed the money. And with that, you had to promise you would teach the Common Core Standards, and of course, they hadn't even been published yet. And here were states already buying into Common Core Standards without even seeing what they were. Well, here came the Common Core Standards. And, you know, lots of people say that Obama was unsuccessful in his presidency. He actually was very successful. He stole the whole country. He stole the minds, souls, and hearts of our kids. And we see that now happening all around us because Common Core is type two. And the whole thing was really to sell and to push the the whole idea of your belief system, the social justice agenda.
Social justice.
Yes. So and with that, of course, came indoctrination of the LGBTQ agenda and, you know, Common Core, sold the climate change. All that stuff is all a part of type two. And we're seeing now the fruits of that. We see generations of these young kids, and remember that Common Core was passed into the schools in around 2010, 2011, and we saw immediately after they started pushing this, it just opened the door wide open, and even before the standards were fully implemented, they were already being implemented in the classrooms across the country. So the kids who were in school, at any grade level, let's say they were in junior high, when, you know, in 2010, 2011. Well, see, those are now your young people that are out there, and those are the ones, of course, who are like the, what I call AOC, which is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she's the one, of course, who, did I say that right?
Yeah, you were pretty
good.
She really
likes her name. She really likes her name pronounced correctly. Mm-hmm. So, but I refer to her as AOC, as others do. Anyway, she, of course, has no basic foundational knowledge and skills. She is operating from feelings, emotions, and she's operating from the whole thing, of course, with Common Core. We saw it has just been coming through the Advanced Placement Program. It comes in through the College Board. Because the guy who was the architect of the Common Core, his name's David Coleman, when he got through doing his damage there, then he moved over and became the president of the College Board. The College Board produces all these different products, such as all the advanced placement materials, the SAT, the pre-SAT.
Oh, geez.
And when he got there, when he got to the College Board, he announced publicly, although a lot of people were asleep across the country and didn't pay attention, I certainly wasn't asleep, and many others who had been classroom teachers and who saw what was happening, he came out and said that all College Board materials would be aligned with the Common Core.
Well, they just about have to be, or otherwise the kids wouldn't know where to go.
Kids who would learn something normal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
we got to take a break.
We have a million questions, so let's take a really quick break. We'll come right back with our guest here, Donna Gardner, and we are talking about education in Texas, but really education across
everywhere.
The country.
Yeah.
So you can find all that great information at wethepeopleradio.us. The Obama administration took over the Department of Education.
Right. Okay, let me go on to the good news, though, because I've talked enough about that. But the good news is that, you know, in Texas, we did not take the race to the top phones, and so we chose right immediately not to go with Common Core. Now, that's not to say that we don't have Common Core in our state, because it came flooding in, of course, through all these different digitized materials. And we have to all remember, too, that whatever is tested gets taught. Whatever is tested gets taught. That's a typical thing that all teachers understand. And that's why a lot of teachers who are teaching the SAT now are not covering the great pieces of the great classic pieces, because they say, well, it's not being tested on the SAT. And they even put in some political questions, you know, talking about the different you know, political figures like Bernie Sanders. There was one question about him saying, why was his speech that he gave some years, you know, a couple of years ago, why was it so so credible, so wonderful, so whatever. Anyway, and so the kids were asked to comment on that question. So anyway, it has become, you know, the SAT definitely has become a Type 2 product. Okay, but the good news is that, well, the fact is, let me go back to that. What I started to say a minute ago is that we have to understand the classroom, that the teachers are forced, you know, when their kids are being tested on certain things, and those tests are going statewide and it's a state mandate and they're publicly shared, then of course teachers are pressured into teaching whatever's on the test. So if your test is Type 2 and your curriculum standards are Type 2, then what you teach in your classroom every day has to be Type 2.
Right.
So that's how they were able to take control of our school. But the good news is that in Texas, we've had, you know, we have fought really hard through the years to keep our standards, our curriculum standards, which is what we talked about a while ago, the TEKS, they call them TEKS, we have kept our standards type 1, which means that most of the statements, most of the elements, the requirements, in other words, in the standards, require, observable, measurable things to be done in the classroom, and they're tested with basically right or wrong answers. Now, you and I know, as an English teacher, Aaron, you understand that there has to be some subjectivity anytime you assign a student an essay to write, because essays will always be graded, subjectively. There's no other way you could do that.
Sure.
Anytime you evaluate a child's writing, it's going to be based upon what you think, and you give them a rubric, and there's some factors that are somewhat measurable, but it's still fairly subjective. But see, when you're in the classroom and you're working with those kids every day, then you know when their writing improves, and personal things about them, and how much they're improving, and you try to encourage them, and you know their strengths and weaknesses. But when it's on a state mandated test, the test grader doesn't know those students, and that's when it becomes the subjectivity becomes very dangerous, because then the kids are totally at the mercy of the person who's grading the test. And if you have subjective questions on there, then you're at the mercy of that person's value system, and that's where it gets scary.
So if you're teaching a type 2 or type 1 curriculum, and the SATs have gone to type 2, how do your students fare on those SATs?
Well, the better students, who read more, can generally do fairly well on them, although not as well as they could, I suppose, if they were taught straight type 2. But see, that's the problem. Now our schools in Texas, that's what I was saying a while ago, they've not been able to avoid type 2 because so many of our students take SATs.
Right.
And the advanced placement. So, yes, that's what I'm saying. We haven't escaped it. Nobody. All schoolers have not escaped because their kids still take the SAT. They still take advanced placement courses in your homeschooling. And, of course, private schools, the same thing. So it is forced. And this was a deliberate plan. I mean, Obama's plan, as I told you, was quite brilliant. He knew that you could take control of the whole country if you just simply made sure that all your College Board material and your Common Core, of course, all the digitized materials coming out, and people have made a huge fortune. Pearson and all these companies, Microsoft, they have made a fortune out of it. Can you imagine what a great deal this was for them when all curriculum in the whole United States had to be new?
Right. So how heavily weighed do the colleges still weigh the SAT as a big part of acceptance to their...
Well, they do, but we are encouraging people. There is an alternative test now. It's called the Classic Learning Test. And it is an excellent test. And we are encouraging people whose kids, who are applying to colleges and universities, to go to the universities to talk to the counselors there, to talk to the people who are doing the admittance officers, and ask them if they would accept the Classic Learning Test as a way to measure a child's abilities. And a lot of the schools, because they want those homeschoolers particularly, and they want those private school students because they know they're better students.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put a case out there and say, I would like for our children, my child or whoever, to be admitted under the Classic Learning Test, a lot of your universities will take that.
Okay,
so
that's good.
Because they want those kids. They,
sure.
They don't want to miss your kids. So I would encourage, and we're encouraging people, to at least approach their colleges and universities with it. And certainly alumni can be very helpful in this. They can be contacting the schools and saying, we want students coming into this university to be allowed to take the Classic Learning Test as an alternative to the SAT. And that's a good possibility. But anyway, so what happened in Texas is this. We fought, but we still have Type 1 standards. So the miracle that came this year, and this is the good news, Aaron, that you're referring to a while ago, the good news is that our Texas legislature that just met and finished up meeting at the end of May actually put into statute, and this is the first time ever. I mean, we can't believe it. It's a miracle. It actually says that all teachers who teach and all principals who are over K through 3 have to go through the reading academies, the scientific reading academies, and they have to be taught, and then they have to teach direct, systematic phonics. I mean, the words are actually in the law. House Bill 3 is what it's called in Texas. And then simultaneously, we've also adopted, actually in 2017, and they're going to be implemented this fall, in the fall of 2019, in K through 8, we're implementing the brand new ELAR TEKS, which are rife. They just have so much phonics and phonemic awareness in them. They're just wonderful. So they are going to be, we have the curriculum standards in place now for direct systematic instruction in phonics. We have the law, House Bill 3, which says that teachers and principals must go through the reading academies. And also another thing coming in, they're even going to have, in 2021, whenever teachers go for, to be certified as teachers, they have to be, and also principals, pathway, anybody getting certified in K through pre-K through 8 will have to, actually through grade 6, let me get it right just a minute, pre-K through 6 by January 1st, 2021, will have to demonstrate proficiency in the direct systematic instruction of phonics before they, you know, those will be on the test questions. So we are really pushing hard all aspects moving into this. And, you know, Common Core, of course, is not, obviously, it's not phonics, it's whole language. So we're defying what's going on out there, and we're saying, look, our state is taking our kids back. We're going to, you know, take them back out of the Common Core. We're going to do it right. We're going to teach them from, you know, from K at the most, you know, important part of time in their lives when they're learning how to read. We're going to teach them direct systematic instruction.
Well, give us a little snippet on a timeline here, because I remember learning phonics, but I'm 57, so I would have been in elementary school in, you know, mid to late 60s. Didn't we go through a phase at some point where we got rid of phonics, or we thought phonics weren't important?
Yes.
We did,
yes,
this once before,
exactly right?
Right?
Yeah, we started getting rid of, there was, of course, it was sweeping across the country. What happened is they came in from New Zealand. The whole language movement came in from New Zealand, and they came in through both borders, both the western side of the country and the eastern side of the United States. And so all this whole language then started converging from both directions. And by about 1981, you know, it had just nearly taken its root in all your states, although there were a few that, you know, kept fighting it off. We kept trying to fight it off in Texas. But eventually, whole language just immersed everybody. And California, I was actually out there in California at the time. I was on the National Commission. I'd been appointed by President Reagan and then reappointed by President H.W. Bush to be on the National Commission on Migrant Education. And so we came out there for public hearings, and I went and worked in the fields with the migrant workers because I wanted to find out what it was really like, and I wanted to get a firsthand view of everything. Of course, I taught English and Spanish, actually, so I had the Spanish background. So anyway, at that point, I was in California when it came out that all of the materials, the phonics materials, had to be locked away in teachers' cabinets. They were not allowed to use them anymore in the California public schools. So that was when it happened in California, and then later on, of course, it was, you know, it was, of course, happening in the East, and as I say, it was converging on the country. And the whole idea was, they thought, well, gee whiz, children don't want to be bored by having to learn these terrible phonics rules. You know, they ought to just enjoy, surround them with beautiful books and big books and
words will just leap out, and they'll be able to pronounce them and know what they
need. Them. Yeah. I mean, just it's, carry them around.
You know, it's funny, I went to Catholic school in Connecticut. You know, the nuns weren't into that kind of thing.
I think those were the ones that had the rulers, and they would wrap your knuckles.
They were actually pretty nice, but they were into spelling, and they were into grammar. And, you know, interesting, even back then, when I went from Catholic school to public school, I was way ahead of the kids in public school, and took the wound up taking the AP exam in high school. I mean, I never did actually regressed to the point where they were. I wound up not taking, having to take English, basic English in college because I had already done it. And I thought, you know, really what they were up to, and we didn't think it was bad. I don't remember being a little kid thinking, oh, our, you know, our stuff was terrible. We've got to take another quick break, Donna. We'll be right back. It's, our time is flying by. I don't know what the deal is, but something, something here on June 30th is making time go very fast. We'll return. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. On the radio. Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu. All right, continue on.
Okay, I was—I don't want to ever. Let me just say this right now before we run out of time. I don't want to discourage people, and particularly young parents who have, you know, who have young children. I always want to leave people with hope. And one of the greatest things is this, Aaron and Bill. We don't have to be at, you know, at the mercy of our public school. We can take hold. We can take control of this. And let me tell you what you do. And we have five grandchildren. And I had told all of our children, our own boys, about, you know, what was happening and so forth, and gave them this book. And this book is called, and I make no money off of any of this. I'm just telling you, this offers lots of hope. A parent who knows nothing about teaching reading at all can teach his own children, and it can come at any time in your life. You don't have to be just a beginning reader. Some of these kids who've gone through the whole language have got to be taken back and just given this opportunity to learn these basic skills. And you start with phonemic awareness, which is understanding the sounds of the English language, the phonemes. And it's a book called Reading Reflex, and it's by Carmen McGinnis, McGinnis. Reading Reflex, and you can buy it on Amazon.com, and it's very expensive. You can now get a copy. I was just looking. You can get a copy less than $2.
Oh, wow.
And it has everything in it to teach. It gives you the instructions, and all five of our grandchildren are excellent students, and they all five learn to read with Reading Reflex. And it's step by step, and it teaches you how to teach them to read, how to print the sound. You go from sound to letter. So, and it is non-consumable. You can use it with your other children. You know, it isn't anything that you, you know, that you use one time and throw away. Can you believe that? A child can learn to read effectively for $2 and write it and spell. So it's really quite a, it's a, just a wonderful thing.
That's terrific. I will post that for the people who are listening while they're driving or doing something and don't have the ability to write that down. I'll definitely post that on the page for today.
And I also have free grammar packets that I wrote myself and used many years in my classroom, all those 33 years that I taught. And if a person wants to contact me for those, I would be glad to send them to you by email. And my email address is wgarner1@hot.rr.com. I believe it's on your website, Aaron. And I do not mind people writing to me and just asking me for my free grammar packets, and I will send them to you. I'll send them in two different emails because it's too much for one email, the attachments are. But you can have those, and you can use those for your own children at any age. A person who does not feel confident in English grammar can take these and work through the packets. They have to be taught in a certain order, and I'll send that to you when I send the email. They were written, they're competency-based, which means you have to go through each packet in order. But as I say, they're free.
Nice. Is it something we could post as a PDF file? Would it be compatible with that sort of thing?
Well, I'll send them to you, and you can do what you want to.
All right. Send me the email you'd like me to post as well.
Sure, I will, Aaron.
My pen's
and they're free. Now, the answers, there are no answer keys because there are people across the country who are actually using them in their classrooms, and we don't want the keys to get out with the answers. But the answers are in the packet. But what the parent does or what the teacher does is you walk right through the packets with the student, and as you go through, the answers are in the packets. So you're going to know the answers just because of having learned the material. And it's competency-based, and you can just walk right through each one of those. There, you run them off. The kiddo writes his answers in the packets, and then he has them for, posterity. One of my students, who's now a DA, told me that he keeps those in the bottom of his drawer in his legal office because he has to refer to his packets every so often. So, they're really, really, these are all things that I always try to make them available to people because I don't want people to be discouraged. And we are starting cursive writing in Texas in second grade with the new standards this fall. So students will be spelling cursive. And, of course, cursive is so important for your next author, the one on Clarence Thomas, because I know it's going to be great. I love Clarence Thomas. What a godly man. The wonderful thing is that students who can, who go through these materials can learn to read so that they can read these great pieces of literature and love their country. And we want Americans to be able to read for themselves. That way they are not held captive by somebody else who is trying to tell them about the country. And if a child can write cursive, then he can read cursive.
Yes.
And if he can read cursive, he can go to the museums, or he or she can go to these museums, and they can read these documents, these primary documents, for themselves. You don't want to have anybody else interpret what those say. You want to be able to read them, and you want to read your great-great-great-grandfather's journals and diaries and all these keepsakes that we all have in our homes. And now kids can't even read them.
They can't sign their names. So if they go to apply for a job or something like that, they can't sign the job application.
Oh, I've had kids look at that when I write in cursive. Kids will look at that and go, "What does that say?"
I mean, that is
a shame.
It's sad. It's terrible, y'all. And that means they're being deceived, because then, just like AOC, I mean, they can be told that document says anything and everything.
In other words,
we've got to equip our kids to be independent citizens of this United States.
They must
learn those basic skills.
I never got in on the why of all of it. What was the stated objective for getting rid of cursive writing in school? Just took too much time, or what was the excuse they used?
It was just too hard. And
I should have. I didn't think of that.
It's too hard.
Oh, yeah, I'm an idiot. You should have figured that out right away.
Idiot. I was teaching whenever
everybody couldn't get a trophy.
Yeah, well, and it said that you could not use red pens anymore on your student's paper. You could not mark, their materials, because that was hard in the
school. Oh, yeah.
I corrected it.
You're bullying.
Okay, I'll just confess. Yeah. I used red pen on a coworker's missive that she sent me at one point in time, trying to belittle me, and it was back in the days before computers. So I red penned it, put it in an envelope, and sent it back to the office and sent it to the front desk so everyone got to see it before she did. And I always had a lot of fun with a red pen as a bully.
Yeah. Admitting your sins right here openly in front of the
whole
world.
Might as well. It's just full transparency.
Well, I'm going to say this because I think the real intent years ago, I really believe this. I think the intent by the evil one, of course, is to make sure that kids can't read well, because if you can't read well, you can't read the Bible for yourself. I think that was really the intent. Of course, now we've got computers that can read for us and all kinds of iPhones and so forth, but still.
But don't they have Bible for dummies? Don't they have Bible for dummies? I mean,
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. But, the point is to be able to read the Bible for yourself, the Word of God. And all of our, all of our forefathers, and the people who wrote the classics, they grew up cutting their teeth on the Bible. I mean, they, everything they read, and the virtues and the, you know, good and bad, you know, right and wrong, all of those were built into the content of the classics. And, of course, sure. if they can make sure you can't read, then you can't read the classics either. So
well,
you take all that out, and you take that, and you leave the kids stripped of all those wonderful values that we just simply learned by just reading these great pieces of literature. You strip that out of the kids. And then, of course, one of the big things that they teach them, the teachers, when they're being taught to teach Common Core, is the fact that you don't teach a whole piece of literature. You give them just a snippet. And you do not, you are not allowed, they call it close reading. And they teach the teachers, and this has happened all across this country, and now we see why the AOCs are out there. They teach them that they are not to teach anything, the teachers not to tell anything about the content, the historical background at the time the piece was written. You're not allowed to give them any context information. They can't study the author's life, what the mores and societal values were at the time. You just give them a snippet of, let's say, of a Bill of Rights, some piece of out of the Bill of Rights. You don't give them any background whatsoever.
Yeah.
Well, see, if you have no context clues and no context background, then you're able, this is what they do. They give them a snippet of something, and then they say to the kid, now, what do you think about this piece of literature, this rule that they made back in 1706? Well, the kid is going to base his statement then based upon our sick and degenerative cultural values of today. And he's going to castigate that person back in 1706 because he doesn't know anything about the culture that was going on at the time or the values or the cultural norms sure. back in 1706. So he's going to base it upon our sick values of 2019.
And also the change in language.
And that's the way to get a right
sure.
answer.
We got a whole lot of words that don't mean what they used to.
Teach them Shakespeare.
Gay used to mean happy.
Teach them a little Shakespeare. To be or then leave it blank.
Right. Yes.
For the life of me, I don't know how they get any jokes. I mean, if you don't know any of the classics, all the jokes go right over your head.
Oh, my goodness. They're all around us. I mean, there's so many references and alliteration and things that are all around us.
It's just sad.
That are based upon the classics. But these kids are robbed of that. They have no background. So they're going through life just simply. And then they feel they have the right to judge.
Right. Then we're going to.
Pieces of, you know, authors and concepts.
Because now they're
the right to judge.
They're the cultural experts.
That's right.
They're the experts.
All right,
we have to take a really, really quick break here. We'll come right back. I cannot believe it's almost over.
If you not be mad, be gone.
Get thee behind me, Satan. Well, that was a different book. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Probably wrong. No doubt about that.
Considering the way we left the last break, yeah. We'll just come back in gracefully. Oh, my goodness. It's just crazy to think that, you know, we were laughing. Well, of course we were laughing because we're always laughing. But we were laughing yet again about, I mean, you always said to your kids, you know, when they said, how do you say this? You said, sound it out. So it means for all this time, sound it out has had no meaning.
Doesn't have any meaning. Let me tell you a happy story.
Okay.
This is about our oldest grandson, and I want to go back and tell a quick story about him. He was he had very serious ear problems when he was young, and when he was about 2 to 3, he could not hear. We didn't realize how significant it was, and since that time, he's had 12 different ear surgeries on that, particularly on that one ear. He had a disease called coleostoma in his ears, and so anyway, he couldn't hear. Well, because he couldn't hear the phonemes that were being spoken around him in his family, and so he wasn't speaking. So here he was, getting to be 3 or 4, and he wasn't talking, he wasn't engaging with people the way he should have been, and everybody was so concerned about him. And so that was when a neuropsychologist told me about, neuroscientist told me about this reading reflex, and that's when I bought the book for our grandson. And his mother faithfully had never taught a day in her life. She had been a nutrition major in college, but had never taught anybody anything. And she followed that book step by step and taught him how to read. And I want to tell you what's happened in his life. He now is, he's just graduated. He's gotten his master's degree from Texas A&M University. He was an honor student all the way through his undergraduate and his master's. And he's July 16th, he's starting his first wonderful job with an international software company.
Wow.
And this is a kid who could have been, y'all, I shudder to think, he could have been a kid that struggled in school and was never able to succeed at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I just give you this example as just one example of somebody that actually learned how to read and to read well, and he's become an excellent student and has a bright future ahead of him. And I'm so thankful for phonics. I mean, it's just phonemic awareness is, of course, learning the basic sounds, and phonics is where you put them together into syllables. And so it's just phenomenal. And I know this is every child could experience this same wonderful success if taught correctly.
Well, it gives them the tools to figure things out for themselves.
Of course.
They are really hamstrung. Yet again, they can't be independent.
That's the thing. If they're all hamstrung, then they will all fit in to the group.
Everybody
is such wrong thinking.
Well, when reading is hard for you, you don't want to read.
You don't read.
Oh, that's
exactly
true. And then it's
so
not.
You get, it's called the Massey Principle in reading. It's actually, they use that term from the Bible. And the idea is that you, quote, get dumber because as the other kids, you know, in other words, you're supposed to be progressing and getting to where you like to read better, but instead you're reading less and less because it's hard for you.
Proven that the written word is stored in a different place in your brain than the spoken word, and you retain information that you read I think better than you do being spoken. But
we try to teach kids to use as many parts, you know, many of the five senses as they possibly can. But as you say, if you leave out one of them, which is visual, then see, you blocked out one of your really important senses that God has given to you to be able to retain and you know, learn these things for long-term memory. And you're exactly right, Bill. So leaving out one of those very important, you know, and for kids that are visual learners, and many people are. In fact, I think they're more visual learners. The percentage is higher for visual learners than for auditory learners. But if you can't read, if you leave out the visual part, you know, you've left out a good part of your brain that's not being utilized for long-term memory.
And let's face it, in school, the kids that were always reading were always kind of earmarked as the smart kids. You know?
Go figure that out.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. And IQ is probably no higher than the kid who can't read.
Correct.
But that child who can read was reading with ease And the more he read, of course, he loved, you know, loved the story. Got to, once you learn, once your brain learns how to call it automaticity, and when you get to the automaticity level where you have learned the sound to letter so efficiently, now your brain is freed up to think about comprehension. Mm-hmm. And see, comprehension then comes once you have this automaticity behind you. So it's become automatic when you see the letters that you don't have to worry about what they're, how they sound and what the word sounds like. And so then you can pay attention to comprehension.
Right, and you can also become kind of a critical reader, so you can look at science, you can look at mathematics. A lot of mathematics comes with writing.
You've got to reason it out.
You do have to figure it out. So a lot of that does involve language, and if your language skills are not good, you're really doomed in most of your other subjects.
Phonics is the basis of all yeah. You know, reading is the basis of all success in every subject in school.
Yeah.
If you can't read, you can't do the word problems in math.
But you look at the kinds of things they're being told. look at the crazy things they're being told are science, you know, all the nutty climate change stuff. And, you know, if you're a critical, if you can read things critically and figure things out, you start reading their stuff and you go, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
I ain't never had no problem with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
I ain't never had no problem.
Then there's Bill.
I'll kill Bill on the break, don't worry.
All right, I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, you're so right, folks.
Well,
so
we
right.
are.
You have a real heart for truth. That's wonderful, folks.
Well,
this is a great program.
It's it's usually a pretty fun program, actually. We try to learn and have fun at the same time, because then people remember that learning, well-being.
That's right.
Grumpy.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, not
well,
good.
I just signed up for your newsletter today.
So oh, very good. We'll have to send out something.
And we have grandchildren in California, by the way. So we're, you know, we go out to California fairly frequently. So we're kind of keeping up with what y'all do out there.
It's been a crazy train. Don't keep it up too close. You'll lose IQ points on that one.
Well, we're finding there's some wonderful people in California.
There are
really some great people.
They're just
really
not in charge of anything. but we can hope, can't we?
Well, there are several different sides to California. I think, aren't there two or three states in one there?
Yes,
yes. Southern California is very different.
And you know, even within those places, there are very different little.
I know.
You know,
where are y'all located?
We are in the far northern part of California, so we're about an hour and a half from the Oregon border.
Gotcha. Okay.
So if you were going to leave LA, you drive about 9 or 10 hours, depending on what's happening.
I get you. But you have a big state just as we do in Texas.
I was going to say it's the same sort of directions you give in Texas, you know, drive
or... We have the same deal. We just don't have a coastline you guys have.
It's just... Oh,
yeah.
Our engineer just told us that the listening radius here covers 7 different microclimates. So thanks for that, Ashley.
Wow.
Well Donna, we have run out of rope here, but we would love to have you come back and give us an update and let us know how it's infecting other states, because we definitely want this to infect other states.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a joy to be with y'all, and I will put you, I think you're on my email list, and I send out things regularly. I cover political, social, and education issues. I research, write, and publish constantly. I'm one of those crazy people. I get paid nothing for what I do. My husband keeps thinking, Donna.
All right.
But that's okay.
Best stuff ever.
Well, thanks for coming on,
totally
Donna.
Supportive. So thanks so much, folks. Y'all have a great day.
Absolutely. Have a great rest of your Sunday. We'll be right back.
Bye.
We'll be talking about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution here at We the People Radio.
We don't get fooled again.
Welcome back to We the People. This is hour two. We're here on Sunday, June 30th, 2019, just in case we replay this at another time. You'll have references for anything we might say that's in current events. And yeah, we won't even go there because there's too much in current events and it's all really bizarre. So we're going to talk about factual things today with our guest, Myron Magnet. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And we do not have a public sponsor at the moment, but we do have lots of nice folks who contribute to the show. And we really appreciate pitching in. You can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. We always post things about our guests, all the previous shows. I've tried to start clustering shows of the same topic at the top of the page. So we have shows about veterans, all the different shows we've done on marijuana at the top. What else did I put up there? Oh, sure. Now I've got to do this. Oh, South Africa. I forgot about that. We've got like 10 different shows on the issues in South Africa. And so that is all kind of gathered for you at the top of the page there. So if you are looking for another topic we haven't done, or you're curious about something and you think we might want to cover it, please send it our direction. You can find that all at wethepeopleradio.us. You've got our emails and our phone numbers for Bill and I.
There you go.
So, moving forward, all right, our guest, Myron Magnet, is a prize-winning author and journalist. He's the editor-at-large of City Journal and author of the new book, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. He previously served as editor of City Journal and a member of the board of editors of Fortune magazine. He is one of America's leading public intellectuals and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal in 2008. He's a frequent media guest who has appeared on major radio. Well, obviously, now he's on our show, so major radio and television programs nationwide. He's written extensively for some of our nation's leading publications, such as the Wall Street Journal, National Review, Commentary, The American Spectator, and The New York Times.
We the People Radio.
And We the People Radio.
Yeah.
His work has covered a wide range of topics from American society and social policy to history, economics, literature, and the American founding. He previously authored The Founders at Home, The Dream and the Nightmare, and several other titles. He has a bachelor's degree from Columbia and the University of Cambridge. Well, how much fun is that? Okay, so now we've exhausted the entirety of our information about our guest, and we're off into the topic at this point. Myron?
How are you, Aaron and Bill?
Well, oh, doing
we
fantastic.
Are super. And, gosh, what a timely... I mean, I know we set this up with Stephen quite a while back, and little did we know it would be right after the crazy train left two nights of debates at our station. Good Lord. It's like, please, yes, let's talk about the Constitution.
Well, yeah, I mean, to get back to something that we're rooted in. You
yeah,
know,
something
I,
factual?
Yeah, well, let's hope it's factual. I mean, to the
well, I know men can't have babies, so we're not going to talk about that.
Oh, really?
Well, you're discriminating against me.
And we are going to play that Monty Python clip one of these days. If you haven't seen it, yes. I want to be a woman. Good Lord.
Oh, yes. Well, let me tell you about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution.
Yes, this is awesome.
It's close to my heart, I wrote it because, you mentioned that I had a previous book, which was called The Founders at Home. And I'm a journalist, so when I have a big question that I want to get answered, I write a book about it, so the research answers the question. And in The Founders at Home, what I wanted to know is, what kind of republic did the Founding Fathers imagine, and what kind of government did they frame in writing the Constitution? So, okay, I answered those questions, but I was left with two other really big ones, which were, well, we don't have that government anymore. So what happened to
it?
What
went wrong?
And is there some way to get it back? And that's what led me to Clarence Thomas, because it's been 28 years now since he's been on the court, and he has written hundreds upon hundreds of opinions, and in those opinions he eloquently sets out history by which the court subverted that original constitution. Scalia, who you know how everybody used to say that Justice Thomas was kind of Scalia's ventriloquist dummy. But Scalia said, you know, compared to Thomas, I am a faint-hearted originalist. Thomas is the real thing, and what he takes to be the original Constitution is that document which the framers wrote in 1787 as improved by the Bill of Rights a couple of years later, perfected by the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War and the 19th Amendment giving women the vote. And what he would say is 232 years after the Constitutional Convention, this remains the most up-to-date, cutting-edge, avant-garde idea of government that anybody has ever dreamed up, because this is a government that doesn't set out to rule you. It's a government whose only function is to protect the individual citizen's right to pursue his own happiness in his own way, in his family, in his local community. Well, that's pretty terrific stuff. And if you read it, I mean, to me, his greatest decision is one called McDonald v. Chicago. And it's really heartbreaking to read the history that he sets forth in there, which is, by the way, something I knew nothing about, and this sent me off on a whole study of Reconstruction, which I never imagined I'd be doing. But he says, I mean, in effect, here's what happened. The founding fathers understood perfectly well that slavery was inconsistent with their principles. Even Thomas Jefferson, slaveholder that all our politically correct schools teach kids that he was,
right,
even he, or especially he, knew that slavery was inconsistent with the idea that he penned in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed with unalienable rights. But the founders could not get rid of slavery if they wanted to get the Constitution ratified.
Mm-hmm.
So they did everything, and it's Lincoln who makes this point most forcefully. If you read his speeches starting in 1854, this is the theme that he harps on and harps on, and that especially in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he's passionate about this. You know, so what did they try to do? They tried to limit it in the Northwest Ordinance. They tried to limit it by cutting off the slave trade in 1808, and they thought that it would simply collapse of its own economic inefficiency, as it was already starting to do at the time of the Constitutional Convention. But guess what? Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin. Slavery moves south, to the deep south, and expands. And so we end up fighting a civil war to make the founders' dream finally come true. All right. Nearly 400,000 Union soldiers die to make men free. And the Congress, which is now, you understand, just Northerners right after the Civil War, passes those great 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And the very heart of those Reconstruction Amendments is the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, whose purpose is to clothe freed slaves in all the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights against state governments. In other words, to protect the lives, liberties, and properties of freed slaves against any incursions by the state governments. Now, along comes the Supreme Court in two 1870s decisions. And the whole country is sitting on the edge of its seat, wondering what is the how is the Supreme Court going to interpret this 14th Amendment? And the Supreme Court in 1873 and 1876 comes up with these two utterly bizarre opinions, and reading them over and reading the dissents, which are furious, it's just hard to know even what they had in mind. But essentially what they said is, oh, those rights contained in the Bill of Rights? No. That's not what the 14th Amendment gives to freed slaves. The rights that are protected are rights like the right to travel on interstate waterways, or not to be subject to bills of attainder. And anyway, the Constitution doesn't confer those rights. It just says that Congress can't invade them. So the upshot is that the Supreme Court basically nullifies the Civil War. And the result is 90-plus years of Jim Crow in the South. And Justice Thomas says, hey, this is personal with me. He said, I grew up in Savannah under segregation, and I know what government oppression is like. So he's it's very, very painful to him that his own court made this horrendous mistake.
Myron, there's no good time
go
to
ahead.
Break this, but we've got to take a quick
please go ahead
little celebration of capitalism here for 2 minutes, and we'll be right back to talk more about Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay. Back to Clarence Thomas.
I was saying, Aaron, that in looking at these awful, really monstrous decisions of the 1870s that overturned the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause, Clarence Thomas began to develop, or really had developed, what is the centerpiece of his jurisprudence. He says, when we Supreme Court justices look at laws that the Congress has passed and the President has signed, and we think they are unconstitutional, we don't hesitate to overturn them. And he said, well, it's our duty to keep looking back at our own decisions, both we personally and our predecessors, and just keep tormenting ourselves with asking, were we right? Were we right? Were we right? And if we find that we or our esteemed predecessors were in error, we got to say so, and we have to overturn those decisions. Now, this is what makes Clarence Thomas a flaming radical in judicial terms. One of the holy of holy rubrics of judging is the doctrine of stare decisis, that judges must respect precedent. And Thomas says, the only sare decisis for a Supreme Court justice is the Constitution itself, the written words as understood by the framers and the ratifiers. And that's it. And beyond that, everything that the law schools teach as constitutional law is really just a bunch of opinions by very smart judges, of course, but they may or may not be correct. And he goes on to say that there are two other large acts in the subversion of the Constitution that the court needs to re-examine and to set right where it went wrong. One of them stars Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, and it was Wilson, our first professor president, who thought he knew which way the arc of history bent much better than your ordinary American voter. He hated the Founding Fathers. He hated the Constitution. And he laid down this theory in which he said, you know, we've got to have a Darwinian Constitution that adapts to the times, that adjusts, that evolves, because everything is changing so fast in modernity. So we need the Supreme Court sitting as a kind of permanent constitutional convention making up laws. And above all, we need this army of Ivy League-trained bureaucrats in either independent or executive branch agencies like the FTC or the SEC, who will make rules like a legislature, carry them out like an executive, and adjudicate and punish infractions of them like a judiciary, all without any separation of powers or basis in the Constitution whatsoever. Franklin Roosevelt supersizes this, and it's not that the Supreme Court did this, but the Supreme Court, with Franklin Roosevelt's gun to its head, validated this usurpation of power. And so suddenly now we have all these bureaucrats swarming over the country and ruling us. And Thomas looks at all of this. He says, this structure has no comfortable home in our constitutional structure. And one of the, you know, the sort of definitive case in which the New Deal court allowed this administrative state to go hog wild was a case called Wickard v. Filburn, which said that the federal government had the right to tell a farmer that he couldn't grow grain to feed to his own livestock. Well, Thomas takes a case that concerns California. So this is, you know, this is in your backyard. And Thomas's case is called Gonzales v. Raich, and it concerns two sick Californians who grow pot and smoke it to control their chronic pain, protected, they think, by California's medical marijuana law. And Thomas says, excuse me, you know, so the feds come and take away their plants, arrest them, charge them with violating the Federal Controlled Substances Act. Thomas strenuously objects and says, this stuff never was bought or sold, never went from one state to another, wasn't commerce, wasn't economic activity. If we allow the federal government to regulate this, they're going to be regulating potluck suppers, right? So, and he names Wickard v. Filbert, and he's saying, this kind of jurisprudence has got to stop. You can't abuse the interstate commerce power of Article I of the Constitution to take control of all human activity in the United States, right? This is a decision that needs to be overturned. And, of course, the third great movement in that subversion is the Warren Court just inventing rights out of whole cloth, rights for gangbangers, rights for students to misbehave in school, rights for people to have welfare as a property right, and so on. And all this needs to be overturned, in his opinion. And, you know, you as students of this stuff will remember that only 5 years ago, constitutional experts like Mark Levin or Richard Epstein were saying we need to have a new constitutional convention as envisioned by Article 5 of the Constitution in order to roll back these excrescences that courts have slopped all over the Constitution. Well, we don't really need to do that anymore because, although, yes, we have certainly had some misfires in the last 2 weeks, we got a Supreme Court that is moving right, that does not hesitate now to overturn precedents that it considers to be ill-advised and mistaken. And we might actually be able to get our old Constitution back. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is that when Woodrow Wilson was putting forth his theory of the administrative state, he was thinking this was super modern, right? Darwinian. It wasn't like these old fuddy-duddies in wigs at the Constitutional Convention. But his model was the Prussian monarch Frederick the Great with his incorruptible civil service. So it's like he's saying what's modern is enlightened despotism instead of democratic self-government. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That can't possibly be, don't you think?
Well, just the fact that the court has to support precedent is saying the court never makes a mistake.
And Justice Thomas wrote a really, really interesting opinion just last Monday, a week ago tomorrow. And he said, you know what? The unwritten British Constitution evolves by judicial opinion. It governed the colonists for 150 years before the Constitutional Convention, but they rejected that. They didn't want that kind of a constitution. But he says, even the British jurists, like Blackstone, for instance, the British judge who wrote the law book that was the textbook for the American Founding Fathers, even Blackstone understood that judges, being human, could make mistakes. So even in the tradition where you really do have a constitution that evolves by judicial decree, even there they recognized that judges could make mistakes, and they were willing to reverse previous opinions that they thought to be erroneous. So what is the problem in America? Why shouldn't we reverse decisions that we believe are incorrect, too, such as this one of Wickard v. Filburn, such as these two monstrous 1870s decisions? And, you know, you really want to light the hair on fire of the left, and such as Roe v. Wade, which was wrongly decided, just to stop it.
And you know, the thing is, it's interesting because the pro-life agenda is getting a lot of traction, actually, just because of the left, and it always happens the same way. They always overreach. They overreach and try to assert things that are just patently either false or crazy or both, and when that happens, all of a sudden people start looking at the truth, as you just mentioned, and then, uh-oh. It's all over, but the unraveling. We have to celebrate capitalism one more time here.
Oh, super.
and then we'll be right back with our guest, Myron Magnet. He is the author of a book called Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. We'll be right back.
It's our time to take a stand. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
There's a call. This land, remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
We were a city on a hill, a candle in the dark. It started long ago. Now we have
we're back. We're discussing The Lost Constitution, Clarence Thomas and The Lost Constitution. What a great title.
And right. What a sad reality, right? That we lost it. And you know, Aaron, one of the points I make in the book is that now at the heart of the bitterness of American politics is, and I mean, you know, we're so angry at each other that we could scarcely speak about politics. And I'm speaking to you from New York. Let me tell you what it's like here.
You know? And we're here in California, so yeah, we're having a hate fest out here, too.
I get it. And I think that we're having a kind of crisis of legitimacy right now. There's a real disagreement about where the authority of government comes from. So guys like us can be said to be the Freedom Party, right? We believe in the Constitution, in the original Constitution, that guarantees liberty and expects self-reliance. But on the other side, there's what you can call the Fairness Party, and they believe in Woodrow Wilson's living constitution, that's his phrase, that evolved,
spooky.
Right? They believe in the administrative state, which the living constitution validated. They believe in making up rules by judges. And what they would say is that in its care for workers, the disadvantaged, the weak, minorities, this represents true democracy in its inclusiveness, even though it so happens that it isn't self-government whatsoever, because everything is being done by unelected judges and unelected bureaucrats. We've given up Republican self-government in this form of government. So I think that we can hardly talk to each other. And, you know, the rage, when people on the left think that settled law, by which they mean Roe v. Wade, might be overturned, it's kind of like, you know, you intend to tear down the statues of all our national heroes, let's say, as if Roe v. Wade has the venerable authority of the Constitution itself. It doesn't. It rests on that previous decision of Griswold v. Connecticut, in which Justice Douglas said the right of privacy comes from emanations formed by penumbras of the Bill of Rights, meaning out of gas and shadows. That's where the right to abortion rests. It's the most amazing thing.
Well, how do you overturn? You know, we talked about the 1870s rulings, and those rulings are still being used as precedent in current cases. I don't know how much anymore, but
very much.
Yeah. So how do you reverse that Roe v. Wade? How does that get reversed? Does it?
Well, you can do it incrementally. So Justice Thomas has an opinion called in a case called Stenberg v. Carhart. Now, Stenberg v. Carhart is a case concerning what's euphemistically called partial birth abortion. And what Justice Thomas says is, you know, nobody ever describes what we're talking about here, because to describe it is to condemn it. So he says, let me describe a partial birth abortion. I'm not going to do this on the air. But he describes it.
But we should. We give them these happy little names, you know. Partial birth abortion, it sounds like no big deal.
Okay, well,
but it's killing a person.
It is killing. I mean, it's killing a baby. I mean, and Justice Thomas quotes a nurse who used to assist at these until she just couldn't stand it anymore, and it's just murder. You know, I mean, when she describes it, it's just plain murder. And in effect, says Justice Thomas, you end up with. With just a kind of pile of parts on a tray, like a fryer chicken in the supermarket. And he said, this is not civilized. This is infanticide. Surely, no civilized community can tolerate something like this. Well, the original Roe v. Wade. I went back and read it to write this book, and. You know, even Roe v. Wade, Justice Brennan says, there is some point at which the state has an interest in protecting the life of the baby. He states it as being after the second trimester. Now, but it was clear even in Roe v. Wade that there was a line to be drawn somewhere, and you could conceivably argue over where the line was to be drawn. Well, by the time you get to Stenberg v. Carhart, there is no line. I mean, basically, the next question is, well, can you kill your one-year-old?
Right.
Can you kill your two-year-old? So, Bill, to answer your question of how you reverse it, I think that that you do it in stages, as Thomas was trying to do in Stenberg. Try to say, please, this is many bridges too far. We really can't have infanticide. So you can do it incrementally, but I also think that there have been so many state laws passed now, either banning or reining in abortion, that this issue is going to come before the Supreme Court in the very near future. And I think what's going to happen is that the Supreme Court is just going to stand up and say, you know what? I mean, look, if it gets the choice of saying we're drawing the line at, let's say, viability, which is where most civilized communities used to draw the line, then you can be sure that Chief Justice Roberts will go for that, and that's where we'll end up. But we could also end up with 4.5 conservatives on the court saying Roe v. Wade was improperly decided, and we overturn it, and we send all this back to the states where it belongs. The federal government, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. There's certainly no, and it's not a question of there not being a right to abortion. The Constitution is a document of limited and enumerated powers. It is not interested in getting into people's bedrooms. The Constitution is about things like interstate commerce and the power to levy taxes and make treaties, right? It's not about the intimate life of individuals. So the federal government doesn't belong in this area whatsoever. So I can imagine a court in the very near future saying, sorry, the federal government has nothing to say about abortion. We hereby overturn Roe v. Wade, and we throw it back to the states and let them decide. And remember, when Roe v. Wade came down, 20-some states had already legalized abortion or liberalized existing legal abortion laws. So we're not going to have a situation in which you can't get an abortion in this country. This is not a Catholic country. What will happen is that there will be a little reason, a little humanity injected into this question, so that we won't be killing babies, which we've been doing for years now.
Yes, and then we call it healthcare.
We call it women's reproductive rights.
Yep, we call it women's reproductive rights. You're exactly right. I mean, language counts. It's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, they slide that sort of thing over into, I know we're supposed to take a break, but I have this tiny rant. It's burdening me. In California, they say that all illegal aliens need health care. So we're going to now pay for their health care. It's like, no, we're not. We're paying for health insurance. We are not paying for their health care. We're paying for health insurance.
You're paying for their health care right now.
But, right? I mean...
You're paying for their health care because they're turning up in the emergency
and they're going to the ER. You're exactly right. It's so frustrating.
I mean, it's absolutely insane, you know. I mean, it's absolutely insane. We have uninsured Americans, right?
Right.
But illegals turn up at the emergency rooms and
well, the great part is the uninsured Americans in California are going to get to pay for the health insurance of illegal aliens. So can't wait for that shoe to drop. I have a feeling that'll be a major comeuppance on the folks that usually think this stuff is so magic. Free will not be free anymore. All right, back to capitalism. We've got to salute capitalism here one more time.
I stand up for it.
We'll be right back with our guest, Myron Magnet. You're listening to We the People.
Stand me now. If sometimes I seem to be mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be mad. Understood. The dream is still alive. Someday it will come true. And this country, it belongs to folks like me and you. So let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country.
All right, Myron, what did we leave out since we have 10 minutes left?
Well, we left out Justice Thomas. We left out Justice Thomas. Let me put in a word. Let me put in a word for Justice Thomas, because his life is something extraordinary, and he draws some very important conclusions from it. He didn't quite go from log cabin to White House, but he did go from a kerosene-lit shanty in a Georgia swamp to the high bench. And you know his story. His by now divorced mother took him and his little brother to a Savannah slum when he was about 7. Couldn't keep him for about for more than a year, during which time he said he knew hunger and cold like it would never end. And then she sent him a few blocks away to her father and stepmother. And her father was this extraordinary man, Thomas's grandfather, a self-made man, semi-literate, but he'd started a coal and ice delivery business, which had become a fuel oil delivery business by the time the boys came to live with him. And he had converted to Catholicism because he wanted an orderly religion. And he brought up the boys in the most structured way. He sent them to parochial school, segregated, but the nuns taught them that all men were created equal and that, therefore, segregation was wrong. And the grandfather put the boys to work in the oil delivery business after school and on weekends from the time they were in third grade. And in the summers, there were 60 acres of kind of scrubby land down in South Georgia that nobody in the family wanted. So he took the boys down, and the three of them built with their own hands a cinder block house and cleared the land and plowed it up. And every summer they'd go there and till the fields and plant the crops and raise the animals and butcher a few of them for winter food. And they lived a pioneer-like existence. And all the time the grandfather was urging them on with these, you know, I can hear my own parents, right? Where there's a will, there years away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he learned self-reliance by relying on himself. And although he was going to be a Catholic priest, but he dropped out of seminary when he saw some racism there that he could not square with what he thought the Catholic mission was. He went to Holy Cross, where he went through a black radical phase. He ended up in a demonstration in Cambridge, Mass., which turned into a riot, in which cops got hurt and property got damaged and burned. And he came back to Holy Cross, and in the morning he went into the chapel and prayed to God to relieve him from his anger against racism, and asked himself, did he really believe in America? Did he really believe in Jefferson's promise? And he decided that, yeah, he really did, and he was gonna give this up. And he returned to those precepts of his grandfather's, which, although his grandfather was a lifelong Democrat and a very active member of the NAACP, that really is conservatism. And he says, to be self-reliant in that way. He said, when we were kids, we read all those kid biographies of heroes, George Washington, Marie Curie, George Washington Carver, and the idea was, here were people who overcame adversity to make their own fates in their own life, and went even further than that and changed the world for the better for everybody. So we learned that you're not just the plaything of vast forces, but you're an independent actor who can actually arrange the world for yourself. Because nowadays, we've got all this emphasis on victims, who, are, they're not responsible for their fate. Large forces made them what they are, and only a mighty government can intervene to protect them against racism, inequality, you name it. And the lesson that he draws from this contrast is a powerful one and very important for all Americans to reflect upon, which is that it takes a special, particular kind of individual and national character to be capable of liberty. You can't have a free republic of self-governing citizens without individuals who are self-reliant and self-governing themselves. Well, in order to have that, you need to have a culture that nurtures characters like this. And if you have a campus culture where everybody is going to safe spaces to be protected from these microaggressions because they belong to micro-victim groups, you're not going to have the kind of sturdy pioneer type citizens that can keep a country free. I'm listening to your theme song and I'm thinking, man, I like this song and Clarence Thomas would like it too.
Oh, good.
Because you can't be a whiny victim and at the same time a free citizen. And it's the job of the culture to have strong families that build strong characters that are the citizens of a strong republic. And this is not right this minute the prevailing orthodoxy, but I think it's what every conservative believes, and what every conservative is trying to do in his own family with his own kids, and it is worthy of the deepest reflection that we've got to do. Thomas says in a speech at one point, he says, you know what, we tend to think that everything is done with the laws, because we're judges. He says, it's not. He says, and he puts his hand on his heart, he says, it's done in here. It's done in here. It's done because we believe certain things, right? We hold certain truths to be self-evident, right? They're deep, deep beliefs. And if we lose those beliefs, then we're kind of losing the culture that underpins that original constitution that guarantees our liberty.
Do you think in the 3 minutes we have left,
No pressure.
That Clarence Thomas's opinions are going to have an impact on the rest of the sitting court?
Oh, yes. And you know, even 10 years ago, he was looked at as this kook out there in right field. But now, the smart liberal law professors like Akhil Amar, for instance, are starting to understand that this is a very profoundly serious jurist, and who has laid out a comprehensive blueprint for how to restore our original constitution of liberty. And here is a very important fact. He's been on the court, as I say, for 28 years now, and he's had a lot of clerks in that time. And he and his wife treat the clerks like they're their children. You know, they foster them, mentor them, stay in touch with them ever after, promote their careers. And 20% of the judges whom the Trump administration has elevated to the federal bench are former Clarence Thomas clerks. 20%.
Oh, wow.
So Justice Thomas has laid out this roadmap for how to get back to the Constitution of Liberty, and he's put the troops in place who could carry that out. And I can name you a couple of people who could very a couple of ex Clarence Thomas clerks who would make very fine Supreme Court justices sometime in future. I think that, as I say, you know, we were in such despair even 5 years ago that Mark Levin was saying we got to have a new constitutional.
Oh, and it is just looking up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Myron, we have hit the wall here. We've hit the wall. Leonard Skinner's given us the signing off music.
Yeah. What a great conversation. I really appreciate
We really
you
want to have
on.
You come back, and I'd love to hear about your other book as well, The Founders at Home.
I'm happy to be California dreaming with you.
Nice. Our hostage this hour has been the great Myron Magnet, author of Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, and we're going to make him come back with us because we like him.
Thank you so much.
Cause that ain't my America, that ain't this country.